From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The coronavirus crisis in the United States has brought to light the question of safety at U.S. food processing plants for both employees and consumers. More than 10,000 coronavirus infections have now been tied directly to meat processing plants. CGTN's Hendrik Sabrandi filed this report on the outbreaks.
These were the good old days pre-COVID-19 at food processing plants in America, at least relatively speaking. These lower-paying jobs have never been easy.
The workers have to process at least 122 chickens per minute. The workers will be standing shoulder to shoulder. The workers pretty much act like machines.
Magali Likoli strives to ensure the rights of poultry workers in Arkansas.
Many of them have to wear diapers because they are not allowed or not granted enough bathroom breaks.
Now, difficult work has often become downright dangerous. More than 10,000 coronavirus infections have been tied to more than 170 processing plants in the U.S.
They signed up for a job to, process meat or protein for this country, but they didn't sign up to die.
At least 45 workers have died of COVID-19, including 7 at this JBS plant in Greeley, Colorado.
And it's not too late for those employees, but it's too late for my dad. My dad's gone, and nothing's going to bring him back.
Likoli says plants like one in her area were very late in providing their employees personal protective equipment and establishing social distancing measures.
So really, the company was not really taking care of the workers. It was not their priority.
Testing of workers for the virus has been sporadic, she says. Paid sick time is lacking, and information about the number of positive cases often isn't shared.
I think sometimes they've been portrayed as being uncaring, but that absolutely has been not the case.
Industry expert Keith Belk says meatpacking companies simply don't have the tools to identify infected workers who are symptom-free.
The ultimate opportunity to control it would be to not allow it into the plant to begin with. And that's just really difficult to do right now. Without really, rapid testing capabilities.
The outbreaks have forced dozens of plants to shut down temporarily, and that's led to meat shortages at some supermarkets. And that prompted President Trump to recently order all of those facilities to reopen.
That really is the key to making sure that food ends up on the grocery store shelves, is taking care of our team members.
Says the head of Tyson Foods, which has deep cleaned plants and installed physical barriers between employees, among other things.
I think they're all learning on the fly here as we go.
The company keeps saying we are improving, we're improving, but we do not have so much time.
This pandemic has put some of the country's most essential and invisible workers in the spotlight. Will the protections they've been given, some say belatedly, be enough to prevent more pain for them and their communities? Hendrik Sabrandi, CGTN, Denver.
New York remains the epicenter of the outbreak in the U.S. as it struggles to deal with a rapid rise again in infections. New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo is already outlining his post-outbreak plans, but his decision to call on America's billionaires to help out has prompted a response among New Yorkers. RT's Caleb Maupin has more.
The United States has the world's top number of coronavirus deaths, and 33 million Americans have now filed for unemployment. U.S. officials are saying this is a catastrophe on par with 9/11 or Pearl Harbor. Many have accused the U.S. government of dropping the ball, failing to provide adequate health care and effectively mobilize relief. However, the New York State Governor, Andrew Cuomo, has found some saviors to help reimagine New York in the aftermath of the pandemic. Billionaires. Cuomo has given Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, the task of helping to reimagine New York in the aftermath of the pandemic with telehealth, remote learning, and broadband.
Probably the best mind in this country, if not in this, on the globe, to do this is, I believe, a true visionary, especially in the field of technology, and that's Eric Schmidt. And we've asked him to come work with us.
Now, Google has already earned the distrust of millions with their Project Nightingale that acquired the personal medical records of millions and their ownership of Fitbit. The New York governor has also decided to bring Bill Gates on board. Bill Gates, the Microsoft founder and billionaire, is set to help revolutionize schools across the state.
Bill Gates is a visionary in many ways, and his ideas and thoughts on technology and education he's spoken about for years, but I think we now have a moment in history where we can actually incorporate and advance those ideas.
Advocates of public education have slammed his initiative as pushing privatization.
Both the Gates Foundation and Andrew Cuomo have a history of pushing privatization and agendas that have the potential to destroy public schools. This collaboration raises a red flag and real questions about what shape our reimagined public schools will take post-pandemic and whether they will be recognizable as public schools at all.
The Gates Foundation are big advocates of Common Core, an initiative aimed at advancing America's performance in education, which is already quite low, especially in the field of mathematics. The program actually has made things worse since 2013 when it was implemented. At this point, test scores are at a historic low. Former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg has been drafted to help out in the field of healthcare. He's set to create a human contact tracing network.
Mayor Michael Bloomberg has volunteered to help us develop and implement the tracing program. We thank him very much for taking it on, because it is going to require a lot of attention, a lot of insight, a lot of experience, and a lot of resources.
Big tech, long based out of Southern California, is now setting up shop in the Big Apple. Many fear that while this could create billions of dollars in profit for the Silicon Valley monopolies, it'll result in even more dependence from New Yorkers on these mega corporations. Now, the pandemic is far from over. NYC is still shut down. But the race to dominate the post-COVID-19 world has already started. And not surprisingly, the billionaires have gotten a head start.
You know, it doesn't surprise me that Cuomo would do this. So, you know, let me tell you about Governor Cuomo. Real New Yorkers see what he does. We see that just in the recent state budget, he cut $2 billion from Medicare. He cut $400 million from hospitals in the middle of a pandemic. We see him, you know, and also he never taxes the wealthy. He never taxes. There's so many proposals in the state assembly to tax millionaires, to tax corporations. You know, to me, it's like a bunch of billionaires getting together and creating new institutions in this post-COVID world. They live in this echelon, this world unto their own. You know, and you really see how they lose touch with, you know, the normal, ordinary person.
With 33 million unemployed and millions infected in the United States, the question has been raised of whether or not we're facing an economic or medical crisis. Professor Tony Montero, however, says it goes much deeper than that. He spoke with Glenn Ford at Black Agenda Radio this past weekend.
That's a very interesting question. My preference in looking at social crisis phenomenon is to look at them in their totalities, that is, holistically, and to see the multiple variables and the intersections and interconnections of points of crises. I think when we are addressing the crisis that we are, which is a total crisis of the system, the health crisis or the health emergency brought on by COVID-19 is but an aspect of something larger. Perhaps we could even say it triggered the crisis points that were already in existence. The economy was in decline, perhaps leading to a recession, but the COVID-19 virus and the inability of the existing political, health, and economic system to contain it merely deepened the economic crisis, because the whole economy is shut down and is moving towards depression levels of unemployment. And the already existing crisis of political legitimacy, of the legitimacy of the mainstream media and other institutions, foundational institutions of the society. These crises of legitimacy have deepened. So I think at this point, we cannot look at this as one thing or the other. We have to look at it as a total crisis and attempt to see the intersections and interrelatedness of all of the moments or points of crisis.
Yes, the mass casualties, especially in the United States, which leads the world, have to be cracked up to an infrastructure problem, yeah. The lack of a real healthcare system in the United States.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, we were going towards the 2020 election, you know, with the nation divided politically, as bad as it has ever been. But the discourses were almost like, everything is normal. Our system is strong. We'll be able to pull our people back together and unite the country with the defeat of Trump. That discourse seems like 100 years ago. Well, maybe 50 years ago in this short time, because there cannot be an assumption that the system can be brought back to what it was before the COVID virus or even before the 2008 a recession. The system will not be brought back. And the political discussion among the Democrats and then between the Democrats and the Republicans and Trump was a fake discussion. That's what we are now seeing. None of them wanted to address, neither side wanted to address the depth and profundity of the crisis that was waiting to happen. A crisis of an existential nature, a crisis that could lead to collapse.
And isn't it something that Bernie Sanders, Mr. Health, gave up his bully pulpit microphone at almost the precise moment that the COVID-19 crisis was unfolding? That is, he gave up his ability to agitate on the health issue at that very moment.
Yeah, unforgivable. But then it suggests that Bernie Sanders was more marketing than it was substance. I don't think, and this kind of proves it to me, I don't know what others would think, I don't think that Bernie ever intended to do a full court press for Medicare for All if he were elected. And the fact that at this moment of crisis, he has retreated from the battlefront or the battlefield of struggle. He has a bully pulpit. He has a huge microphone. He has a following. And he could play a major role in clarifying the nature of the situation and clarifying the nature of the crisis. In fact, if he is really a socialist, he would be presenting either a socialist alternative to the healthcare system and the economic system, or he would be presenting a socialist transition to full-blown socialism. For example, the fact that the crisis is now so interlocked, that is the health crisis and the economic crisis and the political crisis and the social crisis, this is the prime time to argue not just if he is a socialist, not just for Medicare for All, but for the transformation of the entire system away from the rule of the banks, the financial institutions, the multinational corporations, and their political surrogates. And he's completely silent.
Yes, and we can do a comparison of systems under the COVID hammer simply by looking at the death statistics. In China, less than 5,000 dead, mm-hmm. although that's where the outbreak first occurred. In the U.S., more than 75,000.
It's clear. Or take socialist Cuba, or Venezuela, or socialist or communist governed Vietnam. But Bernie, if you remember, made it clear that the socialism that he supports is the Norwegian model, while he spoke about Hugo Chavez as a dead communist dictator. I mean, that kind of white supremacy, calling it socialism, is deeply offensive to me, and I'm certain millions of other people. So at the end of the day, we are faced with a real political and ideological problem where people have hijacked the socialist movement, whatever it was, and have turned it into a movement to reform neoliberal capitalism and called it socialism. And the other thing is, it shows, and this is very, I think it's unavoidable, that the white left, be it the democratic socialist left or the far left left, are not capable of uniting the people or even coming up with strategy and tactics to unite the people. And in many ways, are not trusted by the people, and in particular by Black people, whose polling numbers show that they, as a group, as a people, support socialism more than any other group. So the group that supports socialism the most do not trust the so-called socialists. And I think that goes back to not only what they promise the people, but what the people see of their activity, especially Black people, on the question of white supremacy.
Ruling class policy, and that's bipartisan Democrat and Republican policy in the United States, for the past 40 years has been austerity, shrinking the public sphere. This epidemic is certainly an indictment of that.
There's no question about it. Of the neoliberal austerity state, national security state, warfare state policies that go back 40 years. There was no liberal option then or now. And it shrunk as we eventually went up to Obama. And all they could give the people were images and fake liberalism and fake socialism, while the suffering just continued to deepen. And it's getting worse now. 33 million people unemployed as of this moment that we're speaking. 16% official unemployment. Probably poverty numbers are off the chain, off the scoreboard. They're so high. And I know in a city like Philadelphia, the most impoverished city among the top 10 in the nation, is suffering deeper and deeper poverty, hunger, and homelessness, and it's not being talked about. So here we are. The question is, where do we go from here? As Du Bois put it, whither now and why? What is to be done?
This really does look like a social collapse, but it's not a collapse for everybody. The richest people in this country in the first 3 weeks of the crisis netted $285 billion more.
Yeah, and the people are watching. I suspect that after we're again allowed out into the streets, the mass uprisings could be like nothing we've ever seen. They thought the long hot summers of the 1960s in the urban centers of the Black community, they thought that that was something. I think what we're looking at going forward is massive uprisings, protest, anger like we've never seen. My point is that politically and strategically, from the standpoint of the people, we must come forward with not just outpourings of anger, but outpourings of ideas and methods and tactics and organizations, and yes, united fronts that could realign the country politically and, as it matures, possibly take power. I'd like to restate that. United fronts of the people, guided by principled politics, that, if successful, could lead to a realignment to the left that could take the government. A systemic collapse of this nature, where the ruling class, and they've made all of this money, can no longer rule, where politics comes from the grassroots rather than the elite and their political organs, where the people are maturing politically and able to understand the fundamental contradictions of a system like this, where there is a leadership, a principled leadership coming from the people. If several of these factors can come together at the same time, we could see the collapse of the government and a popular takeover. And that doesn't mean that we've suddenly gone to socialism, but it would be a popular takeover in the name of people's democracy that could then decide how we move forward, what happens with the economy, whether we nationalize the banks, whether we nationalize the multinational corporations, and what we do about labor and unemployment, whether in this kind of situation there's a mass infrastructure development of the employment of the unemployment in rebuilding schools and hospitals and roads and bridges and whatever else needs to be built, including housing for the people. So that's what I'm looking at, and that's what I think about all the time, Glenn.
Once again, the Federal Reserve is creating trillions of dollars out of thin air, which the United States can do. But almost all of it, of course, is going to the big guys, the ones that already have trillions in their own accounts.
That's right. We're back to the supply side, trickle-down economic policies. And it's going to bite the ruling class in the behind, because the big corporations and banks are not going to invest in the people. They're going to buy back their stocks and all kinds of other machinations. But the people will have to decide right now. All bets have to be on the people. And by the way, the people can, you can't BS the people at this time. I mean, you can, but if you do it, you do it at your own risk. And that's why your question about Bernie Sanders, he was not committed to the people. And in fact, he walked away from the whole affair almost angry and bitter at the people. And I would suggest most at Black people for not doing what he thought they should do. That kind of halfway leadership, that kind of leadership, which is all about the self and not about the people, and is not committed to sacrifice on behalf of the people, we have to call them out, expose them, and have them pushed to the side to make way for genuine grassroots people leadership from the bottom of society.
Now, it's not just what happens in the immediacy of the economic downturn. We know that after all of these recessions, there's a great consolidation of big corporate power, a reorganization in which the big guys become even more powerful and the smaller companies become almost extinct. In this situation, we have whole sectors of the economy being tied down by the medical emergency and big capital creating alternative methods of the delivery of services. I'm talking about Amazon, the big winner in all of this.
Oh, yeah. In a certain sense, that is to be expected. That's the pattern of bust and boom, recession and expansion, capitalist economics. This looks like something on steroids, that process, those patterns on steroids. But again, I say, more than anything else, this is a political crisis. And it is a crisis where the question of, can the ruling class rule and do the people accept their rule? If that is not the case any longer, this crisis can be resolved, but politically. And once the question of who rules and the government of the country is resolved, and if it is resolved on behalf of the people, then we can begin to solve these problems. But without political power, without a different type of configuration of power in the country, we will never be able to solve the crisis and the problem that you just put forward. So I'm emphasizing politics, 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 and ideological clarity, the political education of the people, grassroots organization, town hall meetings, labor united, and the labor movement has to get united, but labor has to be united with the Black liberation struggle and the Black liberation struggle with the other struggles for justice, be it gender, be it Latino, be it Native American, but there has to be unity. And the other thing, the other 800-pound elephant in the canoe is this humongous military budget and this ongoing war against nations like Iran and Venezuela and this talk of revenge against the Chinese and just on and on. The people have to address these questions and shut these no good politicians up, including the coward Donald Trump.
And all of this people's heat has to come from the street. But we have experienced something that is also unprecedented, at least in the past 50 years, of cops having the ability to impose curfews and run people off the street.
Well, those are the conditions under which we're going to have to fight. And when a ruling class cannot rule in the old way, one of their options is to turn to police state measures. The people will have to decide this. Now, the good thing is that this is not confined to Black people. If it were just a Black problem, they could isolate it, intensify repression in the Black community, more police killings and killings by ordinary white citizens, and it would go unnoticed in any significant way. But now, this is a general crisis of the people. White people are being hurt. White people are committing suicide. White people are ODing on heroin and other drugs. And so therefore, it is a wider problem. And therefore, the police state measures are not, I don't think, able to deal with a crisis that affects white people. Because see, police, as we know, going back to the time of slavery and slave hunting and all that type of thing, police forces have been developed to target Black folk in particular. You could say immigrants, but Black folk in particular. It is a slave-catching operation in new form. Hence, the question is, will white cops kill white people? Will white cops brutalize white people who are protesting? Some people would say, yeah, look what they did at Kent State 50 years ago. But can they do it on the mass scale that would be required to put down mass uprisings and mass mobilizations defying shutdowns and closed downs and laws and measures that say you can't demonstrate? But yeah, all that you say, the centralization of the economy more than before, the expansion of the power of the banks and finance capital, the growing repression and potential repression going forward, all of that is part of the architecture of the class conflict at this moment. This is why infantile leftism or bourgeois social democracy cannot lead the people. If you think you can come with socialism in name and neoliberal capitalism in substance, the people have already begun to see through that. And you know, one measure of it is Black folks' growing alienation from the Obamas and literally almost forgetting about them as we go deeper into this economic crisis.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.